You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to Beyond the Game. My name is Gregan, and today I'm going to be chatting with Alice Deering. So with your swimming journey, we jumped back and forth from the start to the end of where you are now.
If this can take me somewhere, it's taken me all around the world. I've been to the most amazing places because of it. I've gone to the Olympic Games because of it. I've competed for Britain countless times because of it. I'm going to put myself in that position. Like, I don't really care how hard it might be on my body. I will be able to cope with that. For some reason, whatever reason, my mum's always really been into tech.
Which is part of the reason why I brought you here. You're not just here because of your sporty achievements. Yeah. You're also a gamer as well. Mm-hmm. And this podcast is all about finding out about people's gaming lives growing up as well.
Mm-hmm. She'd always order stuff from PlayAsia. And for example, she had the PSP like a year before it was released in the UK because she ordered it from there. The GameCube, just the graphics for it, just really, I feel like they really spoke to me.
I love the GameCube.
Oh my God, it is a timeless console. Like, I
the
feel
like discs,
yeah,
that went in.
The little handle.
And the intro, the like.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, bad, honestly.
As someone who represents diversity within swimming, you know, you with the Black Swimming Association, you've improved diversity in swimming, and you're a big advocate for that kind of thing. What are your thoughts when it comes to the societal pressures towards women in gaming and the discouragement that's currently in place?
You know, as you start to break down barriers, more people will see that, oh, okay, there's somebody out there doing it. I want to try and go and do it better than them. And I sincerely hope that's what happens.
Make sure to follow for future episodes and let us know who you want to hear from next. I hope you enjoy the conversation as we get to know Alice beyond the game. Alice.
Hey.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited for this episode because it's a very different episode. We typically have people on here where gaming is their career. But for you, gaming is something you love doing whilst a career in a similar kind of fashion of sport as a marathon swimmer.
Yeah.
I want to explore your childhood growing up and where you started getting into swimming, how it led to where you are now. So when did you first start getting into swimming?
First learned to swim when I was about 4 or 5 years old, just basic learn to swim lessons. I can't remember, there was like 10 people a lesson, half an hour once a week. And then just went through those. When I was 8 years old, my mum put me in with a swimming club. We went along once a week to start off with, me and my second eldest brother. And then, I don't know, we just fell in love with it, both of us. I was 8, he was 13, and we really, really loved it. Did my first gala. It was like the club championships, and I think I got like 2 firsts and a second or something. And it just became something I wanted to do. I never got into it wanting to compete for Britain or go to the Olympics or anything like that. It was just like, I'm enjoying this, I'm having fun, let's keep going with it. But then, yeah, it just escalated really quickly.
So now you have competed at the Olympics. Yeah. You know, we fast forward quite a while.
Yeah.
So what, you're 8 when you first started competing.
Mm-hmm.
What point did it start to feel like it could become a career slash your main interest?
Honestly, only when I was about 22.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I was in elite programs from when I was about 11 years old, so it was quite intense already at quite a young age, but it was always something that I did alongside my education because it just fit in really well. And it was convenient, if that makes sense. Like, I put in a lot of time and effort, you know, swimming 8 times a week from 11 years old. So there's a lot to pack in there. But as I got older, it was just kind of like it fit in with education. I got a scholarship to the Royal Roehampton School. So did my education and then went and swam and then went to university. And again, it was convenient to have it at university. And then it wasn't until I kind of was finishing my degrees and was like, oh, okay, I kind of have a choice to make here. Do I move into normal life or do I like try and continue being an athlete? And yeah, that was when I was really like, okay, let's commit to this. Let's try and be a full-time athlete. And I'm actually loving it. It's ideal. I don't think I'm made for an office job, I'm not going to lie.
Well, there is a common misconception with athletes, especially those at the top of their game, that it's a lucrative career because of the fact football is there. And everyone sees footballers and they see, you know, the best tennis players in the world and they see how much money they're all making. But then when it comes to sports, especially those Olympic sports, yeah, where you get that big buzz for once every 4 years, yeah, and then those sports go off and compete in their world championships and so on throughout the rest of the year. But the chances to make money, because there's not as many eyes on it, there's not as much sponsorship and so on, aren't necessarily there. So the fact that you're able to be a professional in the sport that you've chosen is quite rare, right?
Yes, very, 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 very rare. I'm really lucky. I'm really, really lucky. Was supported by UK Sport for like 7-8 years from when I was about 16 years old. Because I didn't compete at the World Championships last year, I've been dropped off that funding. But I've got my amazing partners who look after me and support me financially. And like without them, I would not be swimming because like the time and effort that I put into it, I know everyone works hard. I'm not sick, but like it's a lot of hard work. Mentally, physically, putting your body through a lot. So like, and there are people out there who are doing it for free and, you know, like expending every penny that they get to go into this sport. So it takes a lot of commitment and time and effort. So to be able to make a career out of it is really rare. And like, I never thought I'd get this far either. I think that's what's crazy about it. Like whenever I sit here and talk about these things, I'm always like, I've come a long way. And I'm like, I'm really proud of that. But also really critical of myself, like I want to do better, so just going to keep going.
Yeah, it's been, you know, a long time going. You can't just make it overnight, especially in sport where you have to develop for so long, not just the skill but physically as well. And you do marathon swimming, which I'm trying to think what are the challenges associated with that, because in my mind, I was telling you beforehand, it sounds like the worst nightmare of a sport for me. So I don't like distance, I don't like swimming.
Fair, yeah.
But It requires a lot of endurance, but I think a lot of it comes from the mental side of being able to push through what is quite an uncomfortable competition.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a bit later on about the kind of the challenges around training and the performance psychology. But why marathon swimming?
I get asked this a lot, honestly. I'm always really honest about this. It's not my first love. I wish I could do 50 meters. I wish I could do 100 meters. I wish I could do 200 meters, but I am better inclined for this distance and this event. I'm 5'5" pushing it, like 5'4.5" or whatever. Is quite petite for a swimmer. And, you know, we're looking at sprinters. These are 6 foot women with reaches of over 2 meters or something stupid. Like, physically, I'm not that way inclined. And also, I don't know whether my aerobic system's quite good naturally. I'm just better at distance swimming. So in my mind, it's very much like, if this can take me somewhere, it's taken me all around the world. I've been to the most amazing places because of it. I've gone to the Olympic Games because of it. I've competed for Britain countless times because of it. I'm going to put myself in that position. Like, I don't really care how hard it might be on my body. I will be able to cope with that. But it's worth every bit of effort I put in, basically. So yeah, I'm quite honest about it. Like, I've never sat there and been like, oh yeah, I absolutely love open water swimming. It's my absolute favorite. Like it's just it's so competitive. Yeah, it's really difficult. It is really difficult, but it's worth it. So I'm going to go do it.
Yeah, speaking of your achievements, I think one of the most proud achievements I've heard you speak about is being the first Black woman to represent GB in swimming at the Olympics.
Yeah.
How did that whole experience of getting into that position make you feel?
It was pretty crazy, to be honest, because like I said, when I set out, I never thought. I remember watching the 08 Olympics, and that was my first first time I really watched an Olympic Games. I would have been old enough to remember Athens, but like I don't actually remember it. But anyway, and I was there. I was like, watched Becky Adlington win the 4 and the 8 free. I was like, oh my God, it's so much hard work to be an Olympian. It's really cool, but it's probably never going to happen for me. I'm just quite happy to see like my country do well on TV. Mm-hmm. And then it gets to like 2019 and I realized that I had a really good opportunity to qualify for the Olympics. I was like, okay, let's go and give it a go. And yeah, to like have made a little bit of history alongside it as well with being the first black woman to swim is pretty cool. And I just want more people to swim. Like it's something that it's kind of difficult to talk about because it's obviously race and there's like some controversy around black people and swimming in the past and stuff like that. But I just want more people to swim and it's literally a life skill. So like, just go swim. Blunt, just go swim, go learn to swim.
That's a pretty good policy. And is that the title policy for the Black Swimming Association? Just go swim.
Honestly, this is the thing. Yeah. So I helped co-found the Black Swimming Association. And when I first started out, I was always trying to convince people why they should swim. And now it's only been like 3 years since it's been open, but I've gotten more blunt over the past couple of years. I'm just like, just go swim. Trust me. Your body, your mind will thank you for it. And it's also a life skill. And even if you hate it, which some people will naturally hate swimming, that's fine. Please just persevere with it. Learn how to swim 25 meters just in case you ever need to use it like that. But hopefully you won't have to.
I mean, my experience with swimming, I said to you, I'm not a big fan of swimming. Mm-hmm. I've got quite a funny story with my rapport around swimming. So, because I've got a hole in my eardrum, right? So I find it really hard to swim. I have to have an earplug in when I want to swim.
When they're uncomfortable.
Not ideal. And I was also quite a chunky kid. And so I wasn't particularly fond of working hard in a swimming pool. I liked sport, but I wasn't a fan of swimming. And my report came back after my second run of learning saying that I appear to have got worse at swimming. And so I thought, you know what? It's not for me. But I think I got to 25. I got to 25.
Like,
so I, if I needed to survive,
exactly.
I could flail my way out of a pool. So,
or just like wait long enough for someone to go and help you. You know, learn how to tread water. You know, basics. That's, you got to do what you got to do in it. It's not for everybody. That's fine.
But you got to give it a try.
Exactly. Yeah. At least learn. Mm-hmm.
So with your swimming journey, we jump back and forth from the start to the end where you are now. But there is a big moment that happened for you. You're about 18, right? When you were junior.
Well, junior, 19, yeah, 19.
World junior.
Champion.
Was it 10 kilometers?
Yeah, that's the marathon, 10K.
So 10-kilometer world champion. Talk us through that whole event. Like, what was that like for you as an athlete?
It was cool. It was really good. It was actually my last junior race, and I was quite a seasoned junior racer, if that makes sense. So I competed at junior since I was 16 years old, so for 3 full years. And within that time, I'd also competed in many senior races as well. And I always found the junior ones much easier, which obviously makes quite a lot of sense. Because your mistakes were forgiven, if that makes sense. So often in senior races, if you make a mistake, like you're not concentrating or you slip too far off the back of the pack, that's your race over. Whereas in junior races, I always found that even when I got a bit distracted, because like, this is a 2-hour long race, it's very hard, like, especially when I was younger, it was really hard to keep my mind entertained for that long on the race. But anyway, when I got distracted, I was able to catch back up quite easily. But anyway, I remember on the day of the race, so one of the policies for open water swimming is you have to have your nails cut like short, obviously, because we're swimming around other people, we're all swim as a pack. At one point, like back in the day, people were using them as weapons, like filing them down to points to like scratch and cut people, proper vicious. So now they get checked before we race. I was first to the check-in line, getting my numbers and everything. And I'd cut my nails the night before because I never want the stress of having to cut them there. And the referee was like, they're too long. And I was like, they're not, they're fine. And I think she was a British woman as well. And it was like, because it's a world competition. So, but anyway, and we were arguing about it. I was getting really worked up. I actually started crying. And there was this really kind woman who came over and like cut and filed my nails for me. And I ended up being last out of the room. So I spent about like 40 minutes in there getting my nails cut. And I was crying, like I was really worked up because obviously this is like one of the biggest days of my career so far. Anyway, I walked out and, you know, did the race, won it. There's actually quite a cool video of it. I'll send it to you if you might want to put it in the podcast.
I'll check it out.
It's me actually like winning the race. It's the last like 20 meters of it. And I moved from third to first position in like a little sprint. It was just pretty cool. I remember thinking like, I remember overtaking a girl who came third and was like, oh, okay, I've got second here. Okay, that's decent. I was like, why don't you try for first? And then I was like, okay, let's go. And then like sped up and kicked through and managed to touch out the other girl. But, and yeah, I just, after the race, someone came over and was like, was the girl who was crying about her nails one? And I was like, yeah, that was me. Like, I haven't actually recounted this before. I don't know why I haven't, but like, I just remember being so angry and annoyed, but then I guess it didn't affect me too much. It doesn't matter too much.
Yeah. Maybe it relieved some got stress.
Got something, yeah, something out of
exactly.
You.
Yeah, because it's such a
distracted nice... you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because I was angry. I was actually so angry. They weren't that long. I will argue to this day they weren't that long. But anyway,
but those kinds of things people just don't think about when they see people competing. All the regulations around all the like build up, and like that moment before a race and how distressed you can feel. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the cool things you can understand in esports as an athlete is the stress that the competitors are going under. Mm-hmm. Which is part of the reason why I brought you here. You're not just here because of your sporting achievements. You're also a gamer as well. Mm-hmm. And this podcast is all about finding out about people's gaming lives growing up as well. Mm-hmm. So we'll take a little bit of a pause from swimming and find out about you and gaming. So I know now you're a big League of Legends fan.
Yeah.
Where did it start? Where did your gaming love start?
So for some reason, whatever reason, my mum's always really been into tech and like would always, like when we were growing up, always had like the nichest stuff from Japan. And I can't remember what the website was called, Play Asia. I don't know if any of them, might be some people out there who remember that website, but she'd always order stuff from Play Asia. And she, for example, she had the PSP like a year before it was released in the UK because she ordered it from there. And so we always just had video games and stuff like that in the house. Got two older brothers, my eldest brother was always really into gaming as well, so I'd play with him. He's like 10 years older than me, but for some reason and they never felt like there was an age gap. But anyway, so yeah, we'd always play together. My second oldest brother's kind of into it, but not as much. And it's always been part of my life. Like, I remember the GameCube was like my first like love of a console. We had a PS2 as well, but the GameCube, just the graphics for it, just really, I feel like they really spoke to me.
I love the GameCube.
Oh, God, it is a timeless console. Like, I feel like
discs, yeah, the wedding,
the little handle,
yeah,
handle.
And the intro, the like,
yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Bad, honestly, such a good console. But I think my mum ended up getting every games console under the sun, had a gaming PC, played a load of games on PC as well. Actually, like, I've just, every time I think about my childhood, it is video games. Like, really? Yeah,
interesting.
It's quite like, yeah, I never really went around to people's houses. I had friends at school, obviously, but I don't, for whatever reason, my mum just never really liked me going to other people's houses. I think she's from Africa, it might be a different culture, I don't know. But so we're always very comfortable at home anyway, so I just go home and play video games and like be happy with that. Mm-hmm.
And through having an older brother playing video games, did you access games that you shouldn't have been playing earlier than you should have done?
Possibly. I feel like I was quite good at censoring myself though, because again, my mum was like quite chilled on that whole front. Like, I mean, they had like GTA and stuff, but I think they might have stopped me from playing it. Mm. Ironically,
when it's 10 years, I feel like they'd be a bit more aware of it.
Yeah,
whereas, yeah, whereas like a 3-4 year older brother, they might be a bit sneaky.
Yeah, whereas, yeah, like Robin, my oldest brother, is quite, I guess, protective of me. I mean, he was the one who told me not to have a like feminine sounding name online, not to show that you're a woman anyway, and still to this day I use that policy. Just, yeah, I'm sure that's something we might talk about afterwards, but anyway, yeah, so I feel like I was very protected. I never spoke online with a mic, still don't to this day. I used to go to his room and play like Team Fortress and stuff after school, like TF2.
Wow.
Like, yeah, oh my God, I miss that game.
Yeah, I haven't seen it played in a long time, but it always used to be a popular one. So I used to go to Insomnia Gaming Festival, and that was the big TF2 tournament every year. And they're always like, it was always so passionate. Like, people who played TF2 are so passionate about that game, and you could hear them everywhere because it's one of those games that they've held on to for so long. They just love it so much.
I feel like I'm getting outed. Oh, it's so true. Is this you? Yeah, no, that is me. Yeah, I feel like I saw an article about it the other day. I didn't read it for some reason, but maybe I dreamt it. I feel like it's making a comeback. I don't know if that's true.
I mean, it could do.
Is it? Is it? Okay. Yeah, like a big update. Yeah.
Producer Harry says there's an update coming out, so we've got TF2 back on my horizon.
I feel like it really set up the whole, like, that kind of genre of FPS, personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know much about it before, but the humor, the animation, the gameplay, the classes, like, oh, he's playing spy, and when you'd, like, you see the knife change so you can get a backstab, it was so satisfying. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I love hearing you reminisce about gaming, because I feel like when we first met, so we met at the Commonwealth Games where there was esports event going on, and started chatting to you there, and I could just tell how passionate you were about gaming. So I think without further ado, we have to just go on to the top five games.
Oh, God, okay.
Because we're talking about various games here. So we've got League of Legends, TF2, I'm sure that'll make an appearance. But I'm intrigued, just because you spoke about various consoles, and without going into too much detail of the games, I'm now interested to see which games from each console you're going to be putting in. So,
good way of doing it.
Top five games.
Okay, my number one that I always go for would be the original Fable.
Okay.
On the original Xbox. I replayed that a bit this summer. I didn't actually complete it again. I didn't realize how short it was. Like, I was playing it and I was like, I'm almost at the end. And it was like, I think it was the first game I ever completed. And I remember I just absolutely loved it. And even to the point, like, I'd done every quest that I could do. And I would go on it, I'd buy swords, I'd travel to somewhere else, kill the enemies along the way, and then sell them for profit. And would just do that over and over and over again, just because I wanted more content from the game. Mm-hmm. And
old games were shorter, weren't they? And you just replayed them or found new ways to play the game without just beating them.
And I always played as like the good guy. Like, I never did any of the evil ones. I just couldn't, even when I replayed it this summer, I was like, I can't bring myself to do that. I don't know why. Like, I just can't. But yeah, that's like...
You have gaming morals.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was silly stuff like, I'm not going to steal from this farm or something. I'm going to protect the farm. It's like, and I'm playing The Witcher. And again, actually, so I'll probably move on to that now. The Witcher 3 was a very good game. And I'm replaying that at the moment on the PS5 update.
Also a very good person in that.
Yeah, I am actually doing all the good stuff, although... Something yesterday, it was one of those little cutscenes that happen. There was a guy selling fish, I can't say it, selling a drug, and it killed a load of elves, and then the elves were going to kill him, and I was like, oh, should I intervene? And then I just let them kill him. But there's little things like that where it's like, it's just interesting to see what you pick and choose to be good at. But Gwent in that game, Gwent is so good. I didn't play it properly the first time. I just I can't be asked to learn this little card game. But now it's constantly okay, does this guy play Gwent? Okay, good. Going to every bar, every merchant, and see if they play Gwent.
So that's a card game inside Witcher.
Yeah.
I feel so this is one of my favorite things in video games, is when they have a game inside the game.
Yeah.
And do you remember Club Penguin back in the day?
I didn't actually play it, but yeah.
I used to love the card game in Club Penguin, and it was a very simple card game, but I used to love just playing that. I played Club Penguin to play the card game. It sounds like you're a bit like that with Mitch, and you're I just want to play Gwen. Yeah. You can play Gwen.
I'm literally okay, I want to unlock this new area because there's going to be more Gwen to play. That's forget Siri, forget finding Siri, forget saving the world, Gwen. No, yeah, and then the DLC for that as well, Blood and Wine.
More Gwen,
more people, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm going to complete it again, definitely. That's been a good one.
So we got Fable and Witcher 3.
Persona 5.
Persona 5.
Yeah, let's go a bit weeboo.
Okay, so my only experience with Persona is Joker being in Smash, right? That is Persona, right?
Yeah, that is, yeah.
So tell me, what is Persona 5 like as a game?
It's a JRPG, which is just done to perfection. Mm-hmm. There's so much in the world, there's so many characters. It's probably an 80-hour game. There's probably some people sat there being like, oh, she did it in 80 hours. That's so pathetic. It's probably a bit slow, but whatever. It's probably an 80-hour game. And you develop these relationships with these characters. You get to know them. And Every time, I think I've played it three times now. So I've played Persona 5 twice and then Persona 5 Royal once, which is like, it's basically Persona 5, but with more content. And every time I finished it, I felt like something's been taken from me. I felt like an emptiness. I was like, oh man, like it ends and you say bye to all your friends, you go back to where you were living and stuff like that. And it's like a proper, it's a feel good game, but you finish it and feel like you're missing a part of you.
You get so immersed in it that
you need it there and you're later.
Like, I got to explore Tokyo as like a student, like in the game. And then obviously going to the Tokyo Olympics, I was seeing all the things that I played in the game and I was like, it was just cool. It's just such a good game. Like I think it's one of those where if you're not really into the genre, you probably won't appreciate it as much, but it's just genuinely so good. Like, I really, really recommend it. Yeah.
So we've got two more in your top five to go.
Okay. Okay. Toontown. This is really, really like wild ball. Okay. Toontown was a popa.
I've not heard of this game.
It's like, this is really bad of me. What's like World of Warcraft? What's the name for World of Warcraft? What kind of game?
MMO.
It's an MMO, sorry. Yeah. It's an MMO. So Toontown was a Disney MMO. And it was...
Oh, I have heard of this actually. Yes. They say it.
Yeah. Like, I was a monkey called Dudley. And you could be a rabbit. I can't remember what other characters there were. All like animals. And... these things called cogs have taken over Toontown and you're a toon with your other fellow toons and you have to go and get rid of the cogs. So you go and do battles, you find them in the street and you work up your like classes. Though I think there were 9 like ways of damaging cogs. I used to put a lot of time into that game. Like, if I'm talking when I was like year 3, so I was 8. So this would have been 2005. Wow. Okay. So like,
sounds like mid-noughties. RuneScape for primary school kids.
Yeah. No, legit. I think, yeah, it was like, and it shut down in like 2011, but I think it's got like a fan resurgence at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I haven't actually looked into how good the resurgence is, but I'm the only person I know that's like knows of this game. Like, obviously, like, you know of it, but you didn't play it.
Yeah. I mean, MMORPGs, I feel like they're very hard to make, so a lot of developers don't bother.
Yeah.
But they are the most addictive games. They're the ones you get so immersed in. You know, like, everyone knows the WoW friend or RuneScape friend who's obsessed over it and has been obsessed over it for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And I feel like there needs to be more of them. I mean, I would put all of my savings and money into a Pokemon MMO RPG without even thinking.
Most people would. Yeah.
And one day it will happen. And it won't be a fan-made one. Because there's loads of fan-made ones out there.
Yeah, it's not the same. Exactly. This is the thing with WoW as well. I've always been like, I know I'll love WoW. But there is so much. There's too much probably. And I think it's like opening another universe, which I don't have the time. And gosh, I don't want to spend the money on that. Like,
that's exactly that's what I say.
Yeah, like, it must be amazing. And I wish I'd kind of been able to follow the wave with it. But yeah, the thought of getting into like an MMO when it's like, I don't even know where WoW is. How many years has WoW been around? Like 15, 20?
15, yeah, probably. I mean, it's
so much content.
Established MMORPG is not a fun place to join because they're always going to be behind everyone. And if you play with a friend who's like, oh yeah, I'll start a new character with you, they're always just going to be pulling you along. Like, do this, do this. You just don't fully learn and just try things.
Grow with the world. Yeah, that's the thing. I want to grow with the world. I don't want to be thrust into like a mammoth universe. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, to be honest, is one of the big things I feel with League of Legends now. Mm. Like, I don't know how new people get into League of Legends now. With all of the heroes or whatever it's called, champions.
The legends. I don't know. Yeah, champions.
Because every game is a different.
Yeah, they say champs a lot. Yeah, champions.
So, League of Legends, is that going to make number 5? So I'm not trying to coerce you.
No, honestly, not. I don't play League. I'm gonna be honest.
You watch it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because community is something else. I used to play like. I never played ranked once in League. I used to play blind draft unranked, so as like basic as you can get with it. People would still be toxic, and it wasn't always necessary towards me. It was just general toxicity, and I was just like, it's because you can type. I think that's a problem. Like, I play Overwatch. I play a lot of Overwatch, And I'm too slow at typing because I play on PS5, way too slow to type. And so are other people. There's only so much you can get out. So GGEZ or some, you know what I mean, doesn't bother me. But in League, man, the amount of flaming people would get or give. And it's just so easy to get triggered by. So, I mean, I've got a lot of love for League of Legends. I love the esport. But personally, it's just not the game for me. As much as whenever I watch it, I'm like, I really want to play it again. I don't want to put myself under that stress.
Well, that's the advantage with esports is you can kind of play vicariously through the team, yeah, which you support.
Exactly.
And so I guess we do have to find the fifth game then. I kind of forced League of Legends down. Oh, Daniel, I was like, yeah, you're going to say this, right? It's just always surprised me because I feel like games that have got that bigger effect on people's lives would be something that they'll put in their top five. But yeah, for you, sounds like your game experience tends to come through stories, experiences, journeys.
Yes.
That you remember. Yeah. So I'm interested to find out what number five is.
It's TF2. Yeah.
TF2. Okay.
Yeah. Like I put so many hours into that when I was younger. When I stopped playing it, I had like over 400 hours on my account, and I'd played a lot on my brother's. And that probably doesn't sound like a lot, but that was over like a 2-year period. And I was going to school and I was swimming in between that. Like I would literally come home at about 7:30, go and play TF2 with my brother for like 2 hours. We'd have pizza and chicken and chips, and then I'd go to bed. And this is like not the ideal life of an athlete, but whatever. I was very, very happy.
Because that's it. When you speak about gaming here, we've got to remember that you're in education and have been training as a swimmer.
Yeah.
And not just a swimmer, you're training in longer distances.
Yeah.
So it takes a bit more time up. So I don't know how you fit gaming in around everything.
I don't know either. And then like, this is the thing, I used to play so much on the DS as well. Like I played all the Professor Layton games. So good. I replayed it on my phone recently. They've got the first three as like mobile games. Oh, so good. Yeah, like I played all of those on the DS, Mario Kart, Animal Crossing. I mean, that was obviously more portable. So like whenever I went to competitions, that would come with me. Yeah, I was like, oh my God, what are my top five favorite games? And now I'm like, what's my top 20? Like,
so many. I was a big DS fan. Yes. I played a lot of Animal Crossing too. Did a lot of Mario Kart. Mm-hmm. When I was on cricket tour, we had a tour bus where we were going around, and we all had Mario Kart. We had 8 player local Mario Kart tournaments in the tour buses. And that was the most fun I've ever had in Mario Kart. I like, because you can just imagine, like, you're on the road and you just want a time to pass by really fast. And when you're gaming, if you forget you're on a journey, and then you get there and you're
oh no, wait, we've got to finish this level now, though. Yeah. Did you ever play online with Mario Kart on the DS?
I tried.
Oh my God, it was so hard.
Yeah.
I don't know what country, but all of the Asian countries, like, they had, like, either Japanese or Cantonese.
Japan would be pretty good. Quite into the Nintendo games, yeah.
But like, they would body me all the time. I was like, I don't know what, yeah. And
yeah, I think Mario Kart has always been a tough one online, because most people play Mario Kart at a casual level and they forget there's a whole hardcore community out there who are incredible at the game. And have min-maxed the mechanics of the game.
Have you got a Switch? You've got it on the Switch?
Yeah, yeah. We do Mario Kart here on the Switch. We could have a few games after this if you want.
It's so hard. Like, yeah, there's so many... Because obviously on the DS, it was kind of like... I feel like your kart was your kart and that was it. They might differ a little bit. But you get so many, like, different stats in the new one that I'm just like... I mean, I'm currently trying to max out everything on 50cc. I'm doing it first time every time, obviously. It's not hard at all. But then I'm like... I'm slowly going to move on, and then I need to think about what bike, because I play Rosalina. I'm like, the bike's just really cool, so I have to have a bike. Which bike am I using? But
I don't like the mechanics of the bike.
Because the way it turns,
it's a lot tighter, the turning. I'm more of a drifty kind of person.
Okay.
And that comes from Mario Kart DS, I think. So in the DS, it was so much about snaking and drifting.
This
conversation, if anyone who doesn't like Mario Kart, we're like nerding out over Mario Kart right now. But yeah, Mario Kart, I think, is one of my favorite games to bring out in a social setting.
Yeah, because everyone can play it. Everyone's played it before.
And like, even if you're coming last, you're getting bullet bills, you're getting stars, you're having a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Mario Kart, what game? Didn't make top five, though.
No, it didn't, no.
It's tough now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Move on from the top five. And I will ask you, before we go back to swimming, what was your greatest gaming achievement ever?
Right. So I was thinking about this. This is really hard because I was like, do I say that it's completing Fable? But like, I mean, it wasn't, I don't think it was that hard a game. And I can't remember if there's even settings for it. But anyway, so I play a lot of Overwatch. It's the only like game that I play like in a, not even competitive, I say competitive very loosely, that I play in a competitive mode. Like mm-hmm. I capped out at gold 3 as support last season. I haven't started it this season, but anyway, first season of Overwatch, I was ranked quite high. I say quite high, everyone's going to be like, oh, that's cute. I think it was the equivalent of like platinum or diamond currently. I think it was the equivalent of diamond. And I was like a diva main, and the ranking system changed after that. But whatever I was then, it was like the equivalent of diamond, which I think is quite a hard flex because I've been on a downward slope ever since. But
everyone else is getting better. You're still as good as you were.
Maybe
even better than you were.
I genuinely think that's the thing though. Like, I don't feel like I'm not bad at it. Like, gold's like respectable, maybe. I'm going to tell myself that it's respectable. But I just like, it is quite a hard game now, especially because I started it. I was really into it at the start and I'm still into it now. But I think when you don't play competitive, I think it declines you anyway. And I used to play a lot of quick play because I don't like the stress that comes with competitive. Because like, I've got a group of friends that I play with, and one of them's, he climbed up to diamond, I think, or platinum, I can't remember. He climbed up to either one of those. And so he's quite into it. Then I feel bad with my little gold gameplay bringing him down. So I try to step away from it when I can, but then there's another friend who really likes to play it. So try to balance it out with a bit of quick play. But yeah, I think that's probably my best achievement. It's not even that good.
I mean, I guess it's all relative, right? So completing story games and 100%ing games, a lot of people, that's an achievement. You know, playing ranked in a game is an achievement for a lot of people. Yeah. So it's all relative, but I think really the bigger achievements for you are where it comes to your swimming, which we can get back to now. So let's talk a bit more about that. And what I really want to get into now is what training looks like. So this isn't just for the podcast listeners. I'm genuinely intrigued and interested to find out because from my point of view, I think I learned the most as an esports coach speaking to athletes and finding out what they do to try and apply it into gaming and esports. And I think it really sets a precedent of what is expected of a top competitor in a more established space, because in esports we're still learning and working out what it is, whereas you've got years and years of previous athletes who are telling you this is how we do it, this is what we do, and then you go above and beyond that and set a new precedent. So what is a typical training schedule like for you?
Okay, the training week consists of 9 or 10 swims. I prefer 9, I'm not going to lie. People will be like, if you know about swimming, you're probably like, she doesn't do 10 sessions. What's she doing? I tried 10 sessions last season and it just ruined me. I was like really, really tired. And you're probably sat there thinking, oh, it's only one more session. But anyway, each session's like 2 hours long. So it's at least 18 hours in the pool. That's about, I range anywhere between 50 to 70K, depending on what the week looks like. So a lot of swimming. And then I have 5 LAN sessions, 3 of which are gym-based S&C, so lifting, body weight stuff like pull-ups, a lot of shoulder stability, quite a lot of press-ups at the moment, actually. And then the other two sessions are core circuits, which are only about 20 minutes long, but I feel like I've been really beneficial, actually. Like, I feel like shorter and more intense are better for me. But anyway. And then, yeah, so I do 2 swims Monday and a gym Monday. It's just good as, yeah, reading it out now, I'm just like, okay, yeah. So 2 swims Monday and a gym Monday. And then Tuesday I do a core circuit and a swim and another swim. So 2 swims on Tuesday as well. Wednesday, 1 swim, 1 gym. Thursday, core circuit and 1 swim. Friday is the same as Monday, swim, gym, swim. And then Saturday is a single swim, and then I get Sunday off. And like, I took quite a long break from May to September last year in 2022. And I was like, got into like the middle of having this break, and I was like, how on earth do I do this? Because I was looking at a week.
Sounds mind-blowing just you saying that.
Like, I'm thinking about it. Like, I always sit back and think about, I really pack a lot in, don't I? Like, and my swims don't even start that early. I'm quite lucky. Like, 6:45 is our earliest dive in.
A.M.?
Yeah,
a.m. I don't think I've seen 6:45 a.m. in a good few years. Maybe from staying up too late is more likely that I've seen 6:45. That's
a good life to live. Fair play.
Is that because the water's better at that time? Like, is it?
So it's one of these weird things where, because of the way swimming is, you can get quite a lot of it done. Like, I do marathon swimming, so 10K. I swim, like, cap out 70K, 70K a week. There are people out there doing my event who swim 100K a week, 110, 120K. Like, as long as your body can cope with it, it will be fine, because the water doesn't give much. Obviously, it's resistance, but it's not weight-bearing. So it's not like running where your joints cannot go through that kind of sustained pressure. So because of that, coaches realized quite a long time ago that you can get quite a lot done, and that in theory will make you better. That I personally think that caps out at a certain point. It has to.
There's going to be a point of diminishing returns where you could do another 10k, but there might be something you could do elsewhere that would be better for you.
Exactly. Like, my logic is, if swimming more meters makes you a better swimmer, then there will be people out there who are doing 200-300k a week.
There has to be a point.
So that's why I think, personally, for me, like, I've found with my coach, I'm in a good range at the moment, and I really like it, because it's all about keeping my mind happy as well.
Yeah, because that's something that we have in esports, quite a lot of the hours grinded equals performance, but then there's that sweet spot where actually you could spend an hour doing a gym session or doing a performance psychology session or doing replays rather than playing, which would help you more than having an extra hour of gameplay. Yeah. So it is interesting, because that does apply very closely into esports, because we had that quite a lot in Rocket League. Rocket League is one of the hardest games to grind, because it's very mentally tiring. It's very fast paced. There's no downtime, not like in a lot of games where when you die, you have that downtime. Or in games like League of Legends, there's a lot of like mindless points where you're just farming and stuff.
Yeah, and you're waiting for things to happen, whereas in Rocket League, it's constant.
So people find it quite overstimulating. Same thing with fighting games as well. They find a similar kind of thing where grinding for more than 8 hours in a day is tough. So typically, they're like, in Rocket League, typically players will do about 50 hours a week of Rocket League at max. Some players will do a little bit more than that. But yeah, it's interesting, because that diminishing returns mindset is definitely something I think in esports is starting to learn and trying to work out what it is to do in place of that to get the benefits in other ways. So you mentioned about land work, or I love that, the way you talk to just normal land work. So being in the gym, and what other stuff on top of that? So you've got all your trainings, the physical side. What other things do you do to help you perform?
Massage is quite a big one. I don't get them as often as I can or should. It's just sometimes it's hard to like work the time in so it's convenient, but that's always one that athletes will jump to, getting soft tissue or something like that. I mean, for me, it's video games
to relax.
Like, just to take your mind away from something else, like a different stimulus, because I've obviously put my body through so much. And whilst my mind's working whilst I'm swimming, it's definitely not the main, it's not the tiring factor. It's not the limiting factor for me, my mind. Like, as in, my body will go before my mind, obviously, most people would. But, I think for esports, I'd say, like, just getting exercise in, making sure, because it does make you smarter, right? Like,
it's interesting to say that, because there's just a documentary that's come out called Mind Gamers. It's on Prime, if anyone's interested to see it. And some scientists got people who specialize in mind-based activities, so chess, memory.
Yeah.
There was a Street Fighter pro, and Mahjong player. Nice. And then they had, I think, 77 other participants who didn't get documented in the documentary. And got them all to do exercise for 5 months and see their improvements before and after. And I think it was a 10% cognitive improvement across the board, where some people found higher improvements in some areas, and some people found no improvements in other areas, and so on. And they had a range of people from no activity ever starting to do things like walking and like basic exercise, to someone who was fairly active doing much higher intensity exercise, more cardio stuff, more strength training, that kind of thing. So it's interesting because it is starting to get studied now.
Yeah.
And I think where you find gaming helps you switch off from sport, I think a lot of gamers should look into physical activity for the benefits the other way.
Yeah, I definitely think so, because it's just it's a big change of stimulus. Like, I go from plowing my body up and down a swimming pool for 2 hours to sitting on my sofa just using my hands and my brain, which, like, I really like the quite sharp contrast. I don't know whether that would be something that other people might like, as in like flipping it for them, where if you just sat at a PC, maybe going and lifting something in the gym or something, or going for a swim. Yeah, I just think, like, the more that you put into your body in different aspects will just help your overall performance. That's how I see it, because it's a holistic, like, you've got a lot going on in you. If you take a holistic approach to things, you'll find things. Like, I don't know if you've heard of, like, the 1% like theory in sport, that if you improve 10 things by 1%, that's better than trying to improve one thing by 8% or something like that, because it's much more realistic to improve something small by 1% and then do that over loads of little things, rather than trying to focus on one big thing. So that's kind of how I've, like, seen, like, especially like performance lifestyle, just learning to take a step back, because it's a lot.
Yeah, I like that. I like that mindset. I think it's something that it's easy to forget. You can very much hone in on one thing and really try and focus on that. But then if that goes wrong,
that's a lot of emphasis
on one big thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good idea. I might have to implement that one myself. That one's going to be the new coaching methodologies. But no, the interesting thing for me with the training is the consistency over a long period of time. We mentioned how you've been doing this you've been swimming since you were very small, but you've been competing since you were about 11?
Oh, yeah. Nine for competitive, but then for GB since I was 16.
Uh-huh.
So I've got nearly 10 years.
Yeah, so you've been competing for a long time, and the long, consistent build-up. You mentioned how you had a little break before. How frequent are your breaks? And have you just been swimming consistently for the last 20 years?
So typically in swimming, you take like the month of August off roughly. So you typically get about 4 weeks off, and that's considered like a good enough break every season to just keep going through. But then since COVID, like both myself and my coach, and I like to say other coaches probably have as well, but I don't know if they have kind of picked up that you can take a prolonged amount of time out of the water and still get back in and swim fast, especially in older athletes, because I'm 26 in April, so I'm currently 25. I've been at elite club since I was 11 years old, so that's 14 years of like practice swimming. Like, so that's not just going to go poof if I take a couple months off. And that's kind of the logic that we applied back in May in 2022, and it was really good for me. Like, I really enjoyed it. I went out and did everything I wanted to do. Went on like numerous holidays, had a really good time. But I felt I was missing swimming, so that's why I got back in.
That's where you want to be, isn't it? When you come back to something that you...
Exactly.
Because, I mean, everyone who grinds anything, whether it be esports or a sport or art or music or whatever, it does get to a point where you lose your love for it. And then the breaks are great for the returning love.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. I genuinely missed it and was like, okay, I want to get back in. I've got more to do. I want to do this. And it's been the hardest thing getting back into it. Like, I've been like really good some sessions, and then the next week I've been absolutely terrible and like questioning everything. But I always knew that I made the right choice. So I was just like, okay, now you've made your choice. You deal with it now. And I would do it 1,000 times over again because I had an amazing time. But it's just been difficult getting back into it, especially mentally. Like, watching my teammates who are swimming really well and training really well, and I'm literally getting lapped in warm up and just feeling like this old woman just swimming up and down, just trying to get through it. But it's been really good, and I've still got loads of time until the qualification for the Olympics for Paris, and then Paris itself. So just trying to like work back to where I was, and then we'll see.
We'll get on to Paris in a bit. Yeah. But I do want to ask you about some more challenging topics. And I think it's really important having you here as someone who represents diversity within swimming. You know, you're with the Black Swimming Association, you've improved diversity in swimming, and you're a big advocate for that kind of thing. Now, within gaming, we met at the Commonwealth. You know, I was a big part of the team England getting the women's team together. Mm-hmm. And through a lot of my experiences in gaming, I've had a chance to speak to many women in gaming and find out what it's like and the experiences and challenges for women, and in particular the societal side. Mm-hmm. And the discouragement of gaming for women. You know, you mentioned before about hiding your identity. Yeah. And not using a mic. What are your thoughts when it comes to the societal pressures towards women in gaming and the discouragement that's currently in place?
I just think it's such a shame that it's ever been a thing. And I'm trying to think why it's a thing. I guess it's one of those where it's just been seen as more of a male/men-based pastime, more masculine. I guess games at a certain point were definitely more marketed towards men, especially back in the day, like
especially competitive games, because yeah. It's sort of like you mentioned things like Animal Crossing. Yeah. I remember when I played that, people would look at me a bit like, why is a guy playing Animal Crossing? You know, I'm like, it's because it's a fun game, I want to play it.
Yeah,
you know. And I feel like the opposite is true, competitive games, especially shooters and things like that, where they're particularly masculine in the way they're presented.
Yeah,
I think that's probably a part of it.
It must be. Yeah, it's just, yeah, I don't know why it ever went that way. Do you know what I mean? Like, I guess it's just an industry that catered more towards men at a certain point, especially maybe in like the 80s and 90s. And then as it grows, they grow with it. And it just, I don't know how we got to this point, basically.
It is weird because, I mean, when we look at sport, you know, there is challenges in sport for women as well. And I think there is discouragement in some aspects, especially in certain sports. You know, we look at sports like rugby and football, which are now starting to change in the way anyone can partake in them. I guess in sport there's even the challenge of where you're from, what you look like, that could affect you, because, you know, as we mentioned, you're the first black woman to compete for GB in the Olympics. That in itself, you didn't have a GB role model to look at. I think that might be a similar thing for gaming, where it's you don't have someone who sounds or looks like you or represents you at the top. And I think right now there's a lot of women who are starting to think, oh, I can do this, because they're starting to see it more with things like Game Changers and top streamers and that kind of thing. So do you think role models would be a factor?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, I suppose now the more there is, the more role models there are, basically. Yeah, so like for me, in my case, like kind of nobody had done it before me, but it personally, thankfully, hasn't stopped me, but it might have stopped somebody else from doing it before. And I hope that won't be the case anymore. So hopefully it will, you know, as you start to break down barriers, more people will see that, oh, okay, there's somebody out there doing it. I want to try and go and do it better than them. And I sincerely hope that's what happens. So yeah, it just keeps progressing in that way. But I suppose, you know, with things like Twitch, like Twitter, even Reddit, there are so many avenues that women can get out there and either, like present as a woman or just not, or just, you know, put a mask on or something, but still play video games and still express themselves. So it's pretty cool to see that there are options now for us. But I guess in some ways, like, some of the toxicity from certain parts of the community, and it's annoying because it's obviously quite a small amount of people, but it's strong enough to stop people from wanting to present themselves however they are.
I think it's interesting now with Valorant doing an amazing job of inclusion with Game Changers, and one of the things that I've been really enjoying is seeing top high ranked Valorant male streamers and YouTubers, and just it being normalized that there is a female voice in their comms. And I think that's something that will change over time and be more common. So, you know, you're seeing Radiant Gameplay, the top rank of Valorant, and they'll be comming like you do normally. And because one of the Game Changers players has had the opportunity through Game Changers, is now at a level where they are good enough to compete at the top, is now competing in ranked alongside these top players. I think the fact that's being normalized through Valorant is amazing. And in Rocket League right now, we've got the Women's Carball, we had the Commonwealth Games, we're getting those opportunities. And because of it, the women are scrimming, they're practicing, they're training like they would if they were trying to be a pro, which is something that I think is underestimated as a factor for why women might be worse at games than men. It's because of that opportunity out there. Because you've mentioned your training there and how much it takes to be the best. And I think In gaming, a lot of men know that's what it takes to be the guest, to be the best. You have to put a lot of work in. But then if you're put off before you even get to that stage where you put the work in, how are you going to get to the top?
You're battling against yourself in a sense, because you said this to me at the Commonwealth Games, because like there was no way I could ever be good at video games, because there's no way I'm talking on mic. There's no way I'm communicating with strangers. I'm not putting myself in that position. So I've already capped myself at a certain point. And truthfully, like I'm thinking of Overwatch terms here, that is probably maximum diamond, absolute maximum, with not communicating with my team. Like,
it's also just growing up, you didn't partake in those games from a younger age. So like myself, I've been competitive in every game I've tried playing from a young age. I've always wanted to be the best at it. Even like with Minecraft, like I used to love being the best in Minecraft PvP in my group and stuff like that. So I've always been developing gaming mechanics, I guess. So the point when a new game come out like Rocket League, where there's no convertible mechanics into it, but it's almost like the aptitude to learn competitive techniques. Like I know how to go away and learn new skills. When I picked up Valorant, the first thing I do is look at tutorials, I look at techniques, I speak to people, I ask them questions.
No, I don't look at games like that. That's really interesting. Yeah.
So I think the fact that I knew that I could be competitive in games from the moment I picked them up.
You're already an advantage.
I'm thinking about it like that. Whereas if you're being discouraged from ever competing, you're being told you could never be a competitive person, something, you're not going to look at a game in that way. You're just going to look at it as an activity that's there for fun. So I do wonder how big a factor society is, because when we look at sport, there is a physical difference. You mentioned it earlier just for yourself, in the sport you chose. You know, height is a factor. So we look at sport and we see those physical differences. Currently we have no scientific evidence that there's physical differences for women in gaming. There could be, we don't know. At the moment, societal factor is the biggest factor we know. But one physical attribute of a woman that I'm interested to ask you about, and this is probably gonna, there's gonna be a lot of people who don't want to listen to this conversation. I don't think I asked if you'd be comfortable talking about this, but one of my friends recently posted on their story, and it made me really think about this. They are a powerlifter, and they said when your body can do 180 kilogram squat, but today only wants to do a 110 because because the uterus said so. And I was like, I'd never thought about that with gaming and how periods and menstruation could affect the practice schedule and the competitive ability of a woman in gaming. So I'm interested from you, from a sports side of things, how has the menstrual cycle affected women in sport, and what things have been put in place for women already to help them with that?
I'm be honest, there's not a lot out there. There's honestly not that much out there. So there's like bits of evidence which say it doesn't affect you, but at the same time it does affect you, because your RPE, your rate of perceived exertion, can be higher or lower. So in theory, your menstrual cycle won't affect your performance. It doesn't change your body necessarily, but it can change how hard you think you're trying. So sometimes when I'm on my period, sometimes it feels really easy and really fast. Everything feels light, it feels easy. Other times, complete opposite. And I haven't worked out the rhyme or reason how it works. And that's like me personally. I think it's something that, honestly, as sportswomen, I don't think we talk about enough. I don't think there's a lot of information out there. I actually was like, I'm just coming off my period when I raced at the Olympics, which really annoyed me, because that's actually in my mind when I'm normally at my worst. So I was a bit like, why am I dealing with this now? There's like a holiday pill. There's probably a better term for it, but I think it's called the holiday pill colloquially, which you can take. But I hadn't practiced taking it for then, so I was not going to take that for the Olympics. But anyway.
Sorry to jump in. The pill is something that I was interested to hear what your views were on. So I assume there are many competitors who just stay on the pill, because it allows them to just have control over their cycle. But then the pill has negative side effects as well, which is, like you said, you don't want to just jump in and use it. So the challenges of finding what works for each person, I guess it depends on the person. Like some of my friends have very heavy periods where they struggle a lot. Sometimes they have to take days off work. And in those people's cases, I was thinking if they were a competitive gamer, and that fell on the day of a competition,
like
if I'm ill, I can barely play at my best, you know, and that's something that's a external factor that happens randomly. But if every month you go through a period of what feels like illness. So yeah, I guess this is a conversation that needs to happen.
I mean, because some, like when I'm like leading up to coming on my period, I'll have a day where I'm just angry, like anything will make me angry, and I can't like really control, like obviously I don't lash out or anything, but I just feel annoyed, moody, angry, and just like I can't imagine trying to play a competitive video game in that state of mind, because there's no way, like you don't play well when you're tilted, right? So if you're already like, you haven't even started playing and I'm already like aggravated or annoyed at something. So, and yeah, obviously that can happen to men as well, you know, like, but
yeah, I mean, everyone's got their own like thing which gets in the way of their competition. Like when I'm tired, I'm not as high performing. When I'm ill, I'm not as high performing. Sometimes like dietary factors affect me. I've got upset tummy, then I'm not going to perform as well. So yeah, there's so many facts out there that the human body makes competing harder. But I'd always just wondered if we could learn from women in sport and what they've concluded and what you have come to terms with, whether that could apply into esports well.
It definitely could. I mean, there definitely needs to be more work done. It affects like obviously 50% of the population, but up until probably only about 10-15 years ago, whereas like women's sports really kind of getting taken seriously as it should be. So I feel like the research is a little bit lagging in that sense. Not that it isn't happening, I'm pretty confident it is happening because there's a lot of people who are passionate about this. But yeah, I mean, I've had so many nutrition talks, so many sports psychology talks, S&C talks, but in my whole life I've only had one sports talk around my period, which is just, it's quite interesting. I've just realized that that's happened, and that only happened about 18 months ago, and that was at the behest of one of the swimmers in like our squad. So yeah, it just needs some catching up, I think. But
I guess the challenge you've got is when there are men involved in the coaching system, they're just not going to think about that stuff, right? Because I studied medicine at university, I've always been the male friend who gets told the graphic details from my female friend. So I've always been quite aware of it. And like when I was ultimate frisbee at university, we were a mixed club, and you know, I would get told very openly from my friends who were struggling, they'll be like, I'm struggling to run right now because I'm cramping. And I'm like, okay, well, now I'm starting to think, how does that apply into everything? Especially like you're doing a 10-kilometer race in swimming. Anything that affects you consistently for every like stroke of that race, that adds up.
And so it
is interesting. I guess we'll move on from this conversation because the conclusion is it needs to be spoken about more, and we need to find out more about it. And it's definitely a conversation I want to open up more. And I think that comes from my medical mind of like, I want to understand the human body and what it can do in gaming and what we can do with science to improve it.
Good. That's good to see. Thanks for asking that.
No, I mean, it's definitely a conversation we're going to try and have more to find out more about it. But I'm interested in what's next. So you've spoken about your journey so far. We've spoken about swimming. We've got Olympics coming up 2024. So it's been a weird one because it's been the shortest gap between two Olympics because of...
It's felt really short, actually.
Is it Tokyo being so May? So what's the goal for you with Paris?
Right, I need to get to Paris. And then I just want to perform better than what I did in Tokyo. I was really disappointed with myself. I went in with like top 10 like minimum in my mind. I came out with 19th and I was like, this was just so bad. I hated the race. Truthfully did not enjoy the race at all, especially the last hour of it. But
the last hour,
the
most sports can't say the last hour of it, but
it's crazy. Because I think, so side note, I trained for a 2-hour race, and I even like getting to the point where I'm like, oh, you know, it's kind of short. Like all of the time and effort that I've put in over however many years that I've been swimming for 2 hours, I always find crazy. But then I contrast that with the guys who are swimming 50 meters, and they get 21, the men get like 21 seconds to prove what they're worth when they've trained their whole life for that. It's just kind of crazy. So I should be grateful for my 2 hours. But
yeah, and all the gymnasts who do one routine, which they've been working on, or like one vault to.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, I can't comprehend it being like that, that short. But ironically, at the other end, when it goes terribly, it goes terribly. And you've got like the longest, it was like the longest hour of my life. And I was uncomfortable. The water was really warm. It was like 31 degrees. And then the air temperature was like 32. So
wow,
it wasn't nice. It wasn't nice at all. And then I just was just swimming through it. And was like, I just need to finish. Like I'm never not finished a race. And that is my, like, unless something seriously goes wrong with me, I'm not finishing a race. So I was like, as bad as I'm doing, I'm finishing this race. And got out, cried to the journalist, and then went back to my flat. The village, and then cried some more. And then went home like 2 days later. So before that, it was a really good experience. Like, the Olympics was absolutely amazing. Really want to do it again. But that race was just so bad. But yeah, that's the aim, get to Paris and just swim better than what I did at Tokyo, which truthfully is not that hard to do because I did so badly. But yeah, I know what I want to do in my mind, and I'm going to go make it happen this time.
Do you feel like a better athlete now than you were at Tokyo?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I was shocked at how different the Olympics was, to be honest. And again, you might be sat there thinking like, duh, it's the Olympics. But for context, I'm racing the same people that I race every day that I go to a competition in the world. Like, it's always the same women. There's never really any huge shocks in a sense of like, it's going to be the same women on the start line and it's probably going to be swam in the same way. But I kind of took that for granted and was like, oh, the race will be like X, Y, Z. And it wasn't. It was much faster. And the way that I compete, I kind of sit at the back, let everybody else do the work, drag me through, and then like skip around them in the last like 2K of the race.
Mm-hmm. So a good finish,
yes.
Good finish and sprint.
Yeah, I've always had like that like good turn of speed for the end and can just kind of get into a zone where like it's painful, but you just kind of put the pain aside and just go.
Mm.
And I didn't get opportunity to do that in Tokyo. There's only like 24 people in the race. And I'm used to 80 people. So there weren't as many bodies to like skip around. And it's much easier to overtake somebody when you're drafting. So like you sit on their feet and then come around them and then sit on the next person's feet and then go around them and like skip through.
Like a slipstream kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Like Mario Kart. Literally like Mario Kart. Yeah. Yeah. Literally like Mario Kart when you sit behind them, but are like obviously a lot slower. So yeah, I didn't get, because there weren't as many people, I didn't get that opportunity. The race was way faster than I was expecting it to be. So like tactically just completely screwed up, which was really frustrating because I knew my body was in a great place. Like I'd trained really well. I felt really good. So yeah, but never mind.
So I guess that sitting there is motivation constantly for the next Olympics.
Yeah.
Have you changed anything in your training now compared to what you did in the lead up to Tokyo?
Yeah, I have. I've changed the training model that I'm doing. So leading up to Tokyo, I actually did even less meters than what I'm currently doing, but it was based around my physiology. So it was very individualized and you do these tests and then it comes out with how you should train. And for me, it was saying that I should do like 40K a week, which like that's what 100 meter swimmers do. So you know, I'm going like 10, oh my God, I'm going 100 times the distance, but I'm doing like the same meters as them. But I mean, honestly, like it genuinely worked for me because I was happy. And that's the thing I realized, that I can kind of do any training, my body will get to the right place, but I've got to make sure my mind's there with it and I've got to make sure I'm happy. So the following year after Tokyo last season, I tried to go to the standard distance model, which is, you know, 10 sessions a week, 80K a week, loads of meters, consistently swimming, and then just broke down off the back of it because I was hating it. So this time I've came back and I've been like to my coach, I want to cap out at this. I want to stick to mainly 9 sessions. We can go up to 10 a couple times in the year. I don't think I need much more than that. And he's listened to me and I think it's really been paying off. Like I'm just only getting back into racing now, but I'm already racing the same times that I was racing last year, and I hadn't taken 5 months off last year. So, yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Exciting. Mm. Well, I've now got a reason to tune into to the marathon soon, yeah. So I'm cheering you on.
Well, it's going to be really pretty in Paris. It's going through like the River Seine, apparently, and we're going to be like by the Eiffel Tower and stuff like that. So it's going to be an interesting one, like definitely, because it's, I think it's like a straight line with the race as well. So again, it's going to be really fast paced. Mm. So
at least I guess it's quite ready. Still a river, and then
yeah, and then which is basically like well. A pool, because yeah. It, like, I don't think it's a very wide river either. It's got banks on either side, so like it's basically a swimming pool, but it's just like a 10k length.
So what's the different experiences like in different types of water? Because Olympics is in the summer, so typically the water will be warm. Mm. You're training all through the year, so
I barely train open water.
Okay, you don't train open water much. Yeah. Okay, is that because competitions tend to be in the summer? Or is it just not worth doing?
Or? A little bit of both. So in my mind, I'm like, oh, I need to know where I'm at when I'm swimming, if that makes sense. So like in the pool, it's obviously always 50 meters or 25 meters. That's not going to change. Like you're in a lane, you're with other people, but there's so many limits. It's consistent, basically. It's obviously very consistent. And open water, I mean, the buoy might move with the wind ever so slightly, or it might be different from where they put it last time because they changed the course. So the distances might change, and that could be like a couple meters or something, but that's enough to make the time different. Mm-hmm. So in the pool, I know if I'm swimming 65 for 100, I know what that means.
Mm. So it's good to help you improve your speed and have that consistency with it, so you can become a better swimmer.
And just understanding where I'm at as well, because it's, like I said, I know my body will get to the right place it needs to be. I just need to know, my mind needs to know that it's there, if that makes sense. Mm. So I do certain things in the pool to get the confidence to know that I'm good. That makes sense.
I kind of see a resemblance with you know, training in a gym environment versus a competition environment. Mm. You know, like if you were, say you're a cyclist, you'd spend a lot of time on a bike knowing that you're getting faster and stronger, but then you don't really want to do it in an open setting because it will feel different every time. Exactly. The weather will change. So it helps you to see that progression.
Yeah, exactly. Progression. Mm. That's what it's all about. Whereas open water, you don't get to learn that. And also, like, it's very cold. It's very, very cold in Britain. I think waters in like inland waters are like 6 degrees at the moment. I cannot swim in that, categorically. I cannot swim in that. I would not be able to go anywhere. The coldest that we do for competitions is 16 degrees. So anything colder than that, I've just kind of said there's absolutely no point because I'll never have to swim in that. Mm. So most British waters don't get up to 16 until like May. At the earliest, and then at that point I'm away competing because it is a summer sport. So
it's interesting. I mean when I saw what you did, I assumed you'd be one of those crazy people spending loads of time in open water,
cracking the ice. And then, no, absolutely not for me. No, it's quite ironic, like the recreational side of open water swimming is absolutely massive. It's great, it's booming. And then the elite side is it's quite niche. Like I swim between 16 degrees, but then I've also gone way warmer than what most people would, up to 31 degrees.
Well, you said like the Tokyo Olympics was one of the hottest you've ever experienced.
Yes. Yeah. It was a bath. Literally. I was taking hot baths to acclimatize to hot water before the race. So, it's just, I compete at a higher range of temperatures, basically.
That all makes sense. And so we mentioned about sort of training and preparation for Paris. You have qualifiers. Talk about the structure of qualification and how that works.
Right. So it's changed from the last Olympics. They'd done it the same way up until Tokyo. And then for Paris, it's going to change. Okay. So there's a World Championships in July in Fukuoka in Japan. And that's top three from both the men's 10K and the women's 10K qualify for the Olympics. And then there's another World Championships in Doha, January 2024. And they're taking the top 13 from the men's and the women's 10K. So like top 13 men, top 13 women. And then there's also top continental places after that top 13, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So it's 24 in the Olympics.
Yeah. Oh, and they've moved it down to 22.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So it's even tougher now.
Yeah. It's, yeah, they've moved it down to 22 for the 10K, which is just, is absolutely tiny. But they've added in, like, if you swim the 8 or the 1500 in the pool for your country, you can do the 10K.
Okay.
So there will be some people who probably, like my friend Felix, he's probably going to go do the 10K at the Olympics just because he's going to go in the 8. Well, he's going to do the 4, 8 and 15 probably, but he's probably going to go do the 10K because there might not be anyone from his country who qualifies. So he'll go do it for a bit of fun.
Kind of similar to how in running people do multiple different races.
Yeah.
Like, so like Mo Farah does 5 yeah. and 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
It's an interesting one because like I'm not fast enough to make it in the 8 and the 15, so I'm gonna like my way of qualifying in my mind is going through the world like selection pool. So yeah, so it'll be more than 22 people is what I'm trying to say, but it means the race is going to be really fast. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So before we're getting close to, I know you've got another podcast schedule in the rounds here in London. But before you head off, I do want to ask quickly. So we said about you support League of Legends. Yeah. You're a Fnatic fan.
Yeah.
How long have you been a Fnatic fan for?
Oh my God. I was a Fnatic fan back when XPeke used to play. And I don't even know, like, I watched it. Oh, it was called the EU LCS, this, like, back in the day. I watched it when it was called that for a little bit and then dropped off the back of it. And then when COVID came round, I was like, I'd always like touched in and out of it whenever I was bored, but never properly watched it. And then when COVID came around, for some reason, I was like, oh, I'm going to get back into League. And started watching it again and saw Fnatic was still like one of the best teams. And was like, I used to support them. I'm just going to pick that right back up again. So it was because of XPeke and I just always really liked him. Like, and then that his backdoor on... Carlos, was he called Ocelot? Was his gaming name Ocelot? Yeah. It's one of my favorite video clips.
I'm gonna have to look that one up.
Have you not seen it?
I'm not seeing that.
Oh my God, it's probably like, I think it helped make G2 and the Fnatic rivalry, didn't it? Like,
oh, that's perfect. Yeah. They've been rivals for so long.
Yeah, I think that was the founding of that moment, that XPeke backdoor. He was casted in and he teleported into their base and killed their Nexus whilst they were like on the other side of the map.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, so I don't understand League of Legends that much, but I understand that as a concept. Yeah. Yeah. Like a little sneaky.
Yeah, legit. And then I think someone came back to try and kill him and he kept like teleport, because Kassadin can like teleport ever so slightly, he kept like teleporting around the Nexus and was just hitting it and hitting it. It was really satisfying.
Well, I'll have to check that clip out.
I triggered all the G2 fans.
I'm sure it's fine. But Fnatic, I'm a fan of the Valorant team, so we are connected in that way. But I think it's fun that, you know, Fnatic being the local team for us as well, being in London.
Shoreditch.
It's nice to support them. But it's been great chatting to you.
Yeah, thank you.
We've covered so many different topics. I've been excited about doing this podcast since we met at the Commonwealth, because I could tell straight away you're going to be a great guest to talk about the sport side and all the things you've done for inclusion in sport and your experiences with gaming. I think you're an amazing guest to have in the gaming space, and hopefully we'll get to chat to more athletes as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting to hear. I mean, the schedule you describe has blown my mind, because I could imagine that amount of work to be at the top. And the thing is, you described that as 1 week, but that's 1 week consistently for years. And it's honestly it's inspired me to step up my gym game now, because I am trying to get back into shape, so thank you for that.
So good.
We end the podcast with the same question for everyone, and I'm interested for you, because you've got such a unique idea of what gaming is. So what does gaming mean to you?
Oh, gaming's an escape for me. Like, I like that I can go just be some teenager in Tokyo for a bit, or be a witcher in this made-up world. Do you know what I mean? It's just quite nice to step into someone else's shoes for a little bit, and then, you know, and then be Alice when I finish playing it. So it's a nice escape. Sounds corny, but yeah.
I think that's becoming a bit of a trend of an answer there. The escape answer is, it's nice.
Oh, okay. I'm not the only one who said that.
No,
okay, yeah. Good.
I don't want to say it's normal, but it's fairly normal. Well, yeah, thank you very much, Alice.
Thanks for having me. Sports Social
Podcast Network. Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.